Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. When you're at the top of your field as a respected doctor in transplant medicine, why would you suddenly quit? Why, when you've spent your whole life working toward this goal, would you say enough and walk away? And what does your life look like when you do that? Dr. David Weil is that doctor, and he joins us today to talk very openly about major burnout, something that's impacting Americans in droves right now. I felt he was very honest about his painful journey, about the decisions he had to make, and his life-changing experiences. His new book is called Exhale, Hope, Healing, and a Life in Transplant. I want to share this because he dedicated his book to his father. He said, the best piece of advice I've ever received is from my father. It's right on the dedication page. Stand up for what you believe in all the time, no matter what. And Dr. David Weil did just that in the end and has a whole new life because of it. He is the former director of the Center for Advanced Lung Disease and the Lung Transplant Program at Stanford. He's currently the principal of Weil Consulting Group, which focuses on improving the delivery of transplant care. And we do talk a little bit about transplant care and some of the challenges that both the medical field and patients experience. And Dr. Weil's writing has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Salon, Newsweek, the Chicago Tribune, and the list goes on. He's also been interviewed on media outlets such as CNN. He lives in New Orleans with his wife and two daughters. And let's bring him on right now. The new book is called Exhale, Hope, Healing, and a Life in Transplant. My guest, Dr. David Weil. Dr. David Weil, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you. I love the title of your book, Exhale, because I think many of us need to do just that right now. So it was a perfect title, even if you weren't referring to current times. But this isn't a book about yoga or meditation. It's your memoir. It's what you describe as the emotional roller coaster life of a transplant doctor, how you reached a point of serious burnout and how you came back to yourself. But I want to just go back a few years so listeners know where you started with all this. You worked on the front lines in a very progressive medical field. You were the director of the Center for Advanced Lung Disease and the Lung Transplant Program at Stanford. But I heard you fell into that kind of by accident when you stuck up your hand to volunteer. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was a young intern in 1990, so just a couple of weeks out of medical school, and I showed up for my residency at Dallas at a hospital called Parkland Hospital, big county hospital there. And it turns out that someone, an upper-level resident on the kidney transplant service, got sick, and so they needed somebody just to fill in to do the more mundane task of transplant care. So I volunteered, and I was hired. Yeah. And so the first night that I was on the service, we transplanted a gentleman, and my job was to make sure that he urinated. So I sat by the bedside and waited until it happened, and when it happened, I couldn't believe it. The patient couldn't believe it, and I couldn't believe it. I never thought I'd be so happy to see urine, but I thought it was great, and it was a miracle that sort of hooked me into the field for 30 years after.
Have you ever wondered, if you hadn't raised your hand then, what field you would have gone into?
Yeah, I have wondered that, and I don't know, frankly, but I think all of us can relate to these little moments where the road goes right or left, mm-hmm. and you pick right for whatever reason, and there you're off on your way.
Definitely.
And this was that moment for me.
Definitely. So you describe your day-to-day work at Stanford as being somewhat like a choreographer, but on that emotional roller coaster. Would you just walk us through a fairly typical day? What is some of the highs and lows of a typical day for you in that role?
Yeah, so my job as leader of this 55-member team was to make sure all the pieces and places were working together and going in the same direction. So I would typically spend part of that day, usually in the morning, seeing patients in the hospital who had just gotten a transplant, and then I would go to clinic and see people that had gotten transplant many years ago. And I would then, in the afternoon, have meetings with, you know, the hospital finance people to make sure that, you know, that was all in order, and deal with personnel issues, as you might imagine, just like any other job, you know, when you're managing 55 people or so, personnel issues do come up.
Right.
And I kind of would help manage those, and then try to meet with the patients again at the end of the day before I went home.
So a lot of different challenges there. And I think typically when people think of transplant, you know, somebody being a transplant doctor or working in that field, we forget all of these, the back end of things. So there's a great deal involved there. So what would you say was your biggest frustration?
I think the hardest part was trying to control an uncontrollable process. And so in transplantation, just like in many walks of life, there are these inherently uncontrollable pieces. So we had to pick the right recipient for the operation. We had to pick the right organ donor, had to do the right operation and do the right post-operative care. So my challenges were trying to accept that some of all of this process was uncontrollable, and that it, you know, could not be controlled as hard as I tried. And I write in the book, I tried pretty hard to control all of it. So I think that was the hardest part, is knowing one's own limitations.
Right. And one of the stories, you share stories, patient stories in the book, and you do talk about family and friends too. But one story stuck in my head, because I actually know somebody who had a kidney transplant, and they kind of went through the same thing here. You were dealing with lung transplants, but I think his name was Ken, and he wrote, "I want to die." And
right.
And he wasn't responding. You share very honestly how frustrated you felt with him, because, you know, somebody lost their life so that he could have the organ, but you know, he's a recipient of this organ, and it must be really frustrating as a physician to see that happen.
It was, and, you know, we have, especially in transplant, but I would say in all of medicine, a patriarchal sort of relationship with our patients, and sometimes it goes a little overboard, I must say, where we feel like we're sort of in control of their destiny. And, you know, in that particular instance, you know, we want to honor the organ donor gift, and we want to make sure that, and our goal is that everyone uses that gift to the full extent. And so I was happiest when I got letters and pictures of people climbing mountains and skiing and doing all sorts of stuff that made it seem to me like they really, really were getting the most out of that transplant. And that made me the happiest. And so when I encountered a patient like Ken who was sort of giving up, that angered me, frankly, and I had to use a little bit of anger to try to get him going in the right direction, which ultimately happened. In fact, I talked to him last week, and he's still doing well 12 years after his transplant.
Well, that's good to hear. I love the fact that you have a happy box, because I have a happy box too, where I put all my notes of thanks and happiness of people, you know, doing whatever. I love that.
Right.
Yeah. So you say the book takes the reader through the story of how one can get too wrapped up in ambition, ego, and professional goals, you know, forgetting what truly matters in life. I want to talk a little bit about ego, and, you know, because it does seem that it kind of goes with the role of many specialists in the medical field. They're kind of put on that God platform, if you will.
Right.
So how did it show up for you, and how do you think it got in your way?
Well, I think it showed up most in just becoming accustomed to receiving gratitude all the time. You know, just to be absolutely frank, I mean, if somebody tells you over and over and over every day for 20 years that you saved their life,
right,
it's very difficult to separate out and put that in a little compartment somewhere and not internalize that. I think the mistake I made was to internalize that at times, and thinking that I had some kind of special power to save and lose lives. So, you know, on the upside, it made hand, you feel like I was saving people's lives, and that's a good feeling. But on the downside, when we would lose patients, it also made me feel responsible for their loss.
Mm.
When, in fact, I don't think that any one human is responsible for saving or losing lives, no matter how good a doctor they are.
Right. And it's a massive responsibility, and it was your responsibility to select who got the organ when it became available. I mean, that's a massive thing. And you've had to tell people that they were no longer, Ali, for example, that they're no longer eligible for a transplant because they were too sick.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the responsibility, you know, went a couple different ways. You know, we would have a meeting every week called the selection meeting, which I always thought was this ominous term for this meeting that we would have.
Right.
And we would actually sit around the conference table and decide who goes on the waiting list and who doesn't. And I think patients would like to think that that was a very scientific, medically-based decision-making process, but a lot of times we brought in our own subjective judgments about people and our own values. And, you know, I heard all kinds of things in that room, like, I don't like this patient, or, you know, it doesn't seem like a nice person, or whatever, that didn't have much to do with their medical situation, nor did it have much to do with whether or not they should get a life-saving transplant. But still, those kinds of things occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So that responsibility, I think, I understood pretty early on was an awesome responsibility.
Right.
Then, as you mentioned, on the other side, you know, trying to figure out, you know, if somebody once listed needs to be taken off the waiting list, that's a grueling, horrible decision to make, because you may be talking to a family saying that we're going to take your loved one off the waiting list, but what they're hearing is, you just gave my loved one a death sentence.
Yeah.
And that's the reality of it. And I understood that.
Right. So at what point did you realize, David, that, hey, I'm not just tired and need a weekend off. I am burnt out. I think you said burnt to a crisp. You know, and when somebody is in that state, it's not an easy fix. But what point did you realize you were at that point?
It was actually, and I think that you already mentioned that it was when I was taking care of Allie, a young lady with cystic fibrosis, who we weren't able to find organs for in time. And that failure, quote unquote, and I put it in quotes because it's not a personal failure. It's just that happens in transplant.
Mm-hmm.
I was unable to see that just happens and accept that. But I think what really made me realize that it wasn't going to be a week at the beach that got me back together was when I started to focus on only the times that it didn't work out. And I forgot about all the people that we actually helped and that went on to live a productive life. And there were hundreds of them, but they all kind of blurred into the background. And the ones right in front of my face were the ones that didn't have a good outcome. And if you can't celebrate the good outcomes, then you need to step away.
Right.
And I think all of us are walking around right now, and especially right now, focusing on what's wrong in the world, and there's plenty right now that's wrong in the world. But I think that if we can just step back a little bit and focus on what's right, it would probably help us out emotionally.
Mm. Well, you definitely turned your situation around, and I want to get to that in a little while. But I want to talk a little bit more about the burnout phase here, because I've done extensive research on this myself, because I hit a burnout point a few years back.
Mm.
And I've read hundreds of books over the years about, you know, personal development, human performance improvement, self-care, meditation, positive psychology, sports psychology. I mean, the list is long. But when you're truly burned out, none of that stuff works. It sticks a temporary band-aid on it, or a little glue to help hold things together for a while. But I think serious burnout takes serious recovery. And that first step is realizing, you know, enough. And one of the things you write in the book, which I found interesting and I could relate to, was that you had an issue with the word enough. Enough is enough.
Mm.
You said people, your father would say to you, you know, when is enough money enough? You know, when are enough hours enough? And I think when you're a competent person and you can do it, you keep doing it sometimes when you really should step back. So talk to us about that word enough and how you got over it and dealt with it.
Yeah, I think it's an important word for all of us, because I think it's so hard when you have a lot of energy and you have a lot of opportunity to do a lot of different things, and many of us do. We want to avail ourselves of all of those opportunities, and we want to do it right now. We want to do it today.
Right.
But I guess what I would encourage, you know, everyone to really think about is, you know, in pursuing all of that and being constantly busy and searching for perfection and going as fast as possible. And I talk a lot about speed in the book, because I think speed is very dangerous. And I'm not talking about the drug speed. I'm talking about going so fast.
Right.
When we do that, we forget about the things that anchor us. And for me, it got down to really three things that I had to do. I had to first get myself out of the situation, and then I had to reconnect with, you know, for me, it ended up being the three F's. It was faith, family, and friends. And that was my only way out. I didn't have another way out. And then the final thing I would say is, I do think in this recovery period, and for me, after I left Stanford in 2016, it was about a full year of recovery. You have to develop a portfolio of things that make you feel better, exercise, meditation, religion, you know, connectedness, anything that you can do. But you first got to, I think, remove yourself from the situation, and that's by far the hardest step for many of us.
Right. I mean, I imagine walking away from Stanford. You discuss this in the first chapter of the book. You know, you can sense that tension between should I, shouldn't I kind of thing almost going on. One of the things you say is that isolation is the enemy, and you should have reached out to others earlier. So what do you think stopped you?
You know, I've gotten that question a lot since the book came out, because I had, you know, buddies that I would cycle with, for instance, on the weekends when I was living in Palo Alto, and they were cycling with me right during the time period that the book is set in, and they said, after they read the book, you didn't want to talk about this on a four-hour bike ride. and I really didn't, and I think the reason I didn't, and I didn't talk about it much with my wife either, is because I didn't really want to come home and burden somebody else with all of what was going on. And to me, it felt like dumping on that person. And if we're out in the Santa Cruz Mountains riding our bikes, I didn't want to talk about a young mother who had just died.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't seem right. So I was left with really no one to talk to it about. And in fact, I think in our medical training, we're discouraged from talking about it with each other, sharing our vulnerability and our emotions. That's not a thing that doctors like me are trained to do.
Right. Part of that patriarchal system that you mentioned earlier, too.
Yes.
So you talked about the three F's, family, friends, and faith. And I know you took a religious journey, which you discuss in the book. But what about faith in oneself? Did you ever lose that? Did you always keep faith in yourself that you were going to work through this?
I thought that... Well, to answer your question more directly, I was concerned about that. I did lose some faith in myself, in that I spent some of the time scolding myself for not being able to handle the situation better. It was a lot of banging on myself about, look, why don't you just suck it up, toughen up, you know, mm-hmm. keep doing the job. I mean, you know, go forward. That's what you've always done. But then when you realize that tool doesn't really work anymore, that's when you lose confidence. And I did lose some confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me to get out of the environment, to reorient my life, to regain that confidence. But I definitely thought I lost it, because, you know, let's face it, I think many people view a burned-out individual as somehow not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they weren't resilient enough, or they didn't have the toughness to get through it. And I think that that's a mistake, and I don't think people like that should be viewed that way, but I think that that still happens, and it still happens in healthcare, I know.
Yeah, and, you know, I can say that, I've consulted for many years, and there are certain projects that I've come off, and I've chosen to take a break afterwards because I needed to detox from that particular project and environment.
Yeah, right.
So it's a very common thing. I know people in the tech field, you know, who work all hours and ran into somebody actually when I was bald eagle spotting one day on a boat trip. And she had just left a major tech company. And so somebody asked her a question about it. She said, I can't talk about it. And she burst into tears. And I just gave her a hug. I said, hey, I've been there. I know what you're talking about. Don't feel you have to talk. It takes a while. It takes a minute.
Yep.
You write your book, Exhale. How do you feel you benefited from getting that down on paper? This is also always supposed to be great therapy. And I know, I loved in the back of the book, you gave a nod to New York Times bestselling author, Dani Shapiro. We've had her on the show before. You said that she showed you through her own writing that crafting a memoir can lead to understanding and healing. So did that happen for you?
It did. And I got the first draft out, and I really feel like it just came out of me. And I really drafted the entire 85,000-word book in about 3 or 4 months. And it really was kind of
It was
of
ready to come out.
And then, of course, I went back and edited it for 2 years with a lot of help, I might add. But Danny's writing, and I've gotten the chance to work with her, and she's sort of, you know, my idol because she understands, I think, what putting words down on a page can do to you emotionally. I mean, it has just the ability. There's something about, you know, getting those words out of your head onto the page mm-hmm. that I find therapeutic. And what I'm really intrigued about now, though, as I talk about the book with, you know, hospitals across the country and, you know, young doctors and everything else, is it might be therapeutic for them, too, to, you know, hear the story of someone who, at least theoretically, was at the top of their profession. And it can happen to anybody. You know?
Absolutely.
And so if it was just therapeutic for me, that would be nice. But I'm really hopeful that there's readers, you know, in medicine and in other fields. And I've spoken to groups, you know, Wall Street traders, airline pilots, lawyers. I think it applies to all of us. If I can help somebody out there that might be going through the same thing, then it's mission accomplished as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, well, I can tell you we've had doctors and all kinds of people on the show who've experienced similar things to you and told their own story in their own way. This is very, very relatable, David. So job well done. You said that the central theme of Dani Shapiro's teaching was that what we write about chooses us, and it sounds as though this was ready to just pour out of you. It scares us and it needs to be written. So was there something about writing that did scare you, or did it just go as easy as you just said in those 3 to 4 months?
No, it came out easily, but it did scare me, if that makes sense. I mean, it scared me a little bit because I was trying to touch down into some very serious, deep themes. You know, my relationship with my father, my relationship to my work. What about my relationship to my wife? I mean, these are pretty heavy themes. And so while I felt like it was pretty obvious that I needed to write about them, I didn't really know what direction they would ultimately go. And yeah, Dani talks a lot about it. You know, what we write about chases us and eventually announces itself.
Right.
You know, as I'm kind of working on ideas for a second book, I'm waiting for that. I'm sort of seeing, you know, what's the next thing for me? You know, what's chasing me? And that's an interesting process as well. But in writing Exhale, I didn't have to do that because it was very obvious what I needed to write about.
Right, right. You also give shout outs to others who influenced your understanding of the writing of a memoir. One of them was Carl Weber, who you say is you say you learned about story shape from him. What did you learn about story shape that helped you put this together?
I think that, you know, it's one thing to have a lot of scenes in your head, to have a pretty good idea for a book, and maybe you have a few scenes. But it's another thing to try to craft a story that wants people to turn the next page and to build that tension in the story. And I think Carl and I talked quite a bit about, you know, ending chapters, making the person want to go to the next chapter. You know, what's the tension here? You know, what's the narrative arc that keeps people driving through the story? And I think that that's something I just basically had to learn. I don't think anybody is necessarily gifted with that. I had to learn that.
I'd like to ask you, I'd like to throw three words out to you and ask you if these mean something different to you now than they did before, what they actually mean to you now. And the first word is discipline.
Yeah, discipline has traditionally meant all in, drive all the time, keep going. It didn't necessarily mean focus. I think discipline now to me means focus, and sometimes that means slow focus. I think all I understood was fast focus. You know, go as fast as you can, go as hard as you can. And I think that, you know, having that one tool to rely on probably isn't going to sustain any of us for very long.
Right. What about creativity?
Yeah, creativity is something that I've struggled with because, you know, in our medical training, and in fact, in the conduct of our medical career, a lot of us, well, creativity is not rewarded. It's actually discouraged in many ways. And I think that this outlet that I've been able to at least begin to develop allows me to think of stories and think of stories that might belong in a book, that might belong on a TV episode, and it's opened up a new world to me. So I kind of see it much more clearly now than I did when I was practicing medicine, which requires going from A to B to C to D, you know, in a very linear fashion.
Right, right. And what about spontaneity?
Yeah, spontaneity, I think I'm still working on. I'm a planner, and my wife and I talk about this all the time. She's not, and I am. And I think that spontaneity is probably something that I need to work harder on because, you know, for me, there's a plan for everything, getting to the airport on time, to writing a book, to taking care of patients, to driving to a restaurant.
Right.
It's all planned out, and I think I could work on that a little bit harder.
Right. Interesting side note here. I watched an interview with the world's number one ultra runner. She's won the world ultra running race twice, 240 kilometers we're talking about. Beat everybody by 10 hours on one of those races. And she has no plan, no coach, no training schedule, no nothing. She just wakes up and sees what she feels like doing, which usually is training because she enjoys it. But interesting.
She must be a great athlete. Yeah,
yeah.
That's incredible.
So when you're writing the book, did you find yourself self-censoring in any way?
I think I did initially. I don't think that I dug deep enough at the beginning, which is common for early memoir writers. I think you just want to tell the story and you kind of superficially go over your own feelings. But I think as I developed my skill somewhat, I still have a ways to go, but I think that I developed the skill to go a little bit deeper into what I was truly thinking. And I hope the book came across as honest because that's really what I wanted to achieve. I didn't want to sit down and write a book and either make it a fluff piece about me or not be honest about what I was really feeling because I wouldn't see the point in that really. So I hope I was able to do that.
Yeah, I think it was very honest. That's how I read it, as open and honest. And you are now principal of Weill Consulting Group, so you're focusing now on improving the delivery of transplant care. So it sounds as though you took one of the biggest frustrations of your old role and turned it into an opportunity to help patients by improving the system there.
Yeah, I basically, when I left Stanford, I basically got out of legal pad and said, you know, okay, you're not going to be taking care of patients. What else do you do well? And I was hoping the paper wouldn't be blank at the end of the session. But One thing that I think I actually was able to do pretty well during the course of my career is build programs that work for patients. And what happens in transplantation is there's a lot of moving parts and there's big teams and sometimes they fight and there's, you know, hospital politics and finances and all this stuff that forgets about that there's a patient at the center of all of this, you know.
Right,
that's
right.
That's why we're there. So when I decided to open up my consulting practice, I thought that I could help transplant programs perform better, whether it's heart, lung, kidney, or liver, because the themes are fairly common among all the solid organs. So what our team does right now is we go in, we assess the situation, and the situations vary. Sometimes the medical care is not very good. Sometimes the hospital administration isn't set up right. Sometimes the finances aren't there. Sometimes the teams are dysfunctional. And whatever the issue is, you know, we seem to be able to help transplant programs get through that. And I guess what I figure now is if I can help the transplant programs perform better, then that helps real people.
Mm.
So that's what gets me up in the morning now.
Yeah, it's good to hear. And what do you want people to know about transplants and becoming organ donors, or if they're waiting? What do you want people to know? What's something out there that maybe people most misunderstand?
Yeah, first of all, that if you're approached about organ donation, please consent. There's 8 lives that can be saved with each organ donor. And I think right now in America, only about half of the people that are approached for organ donation agree, so 50% don't agree. And I think a lot of that is socioeconomic. There's racial disparities with regard to organ donation. And there's just a poor understanding that brain death means death. If your doctors tell you that one of your loved ones, God forbid, is brain dead, that means they're dead. Even if their heart's still beating, that means they're dead.
Right.
And I think that if I can get across that message about how fulfilling it is to be able to save so many other people's lives, to turn whatever tragedy happened into a positive, I think folks should avail themselves of that opportunity. It's an amazing feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's awesome. Dr. David Weil, it's been great talking with you about your new book, Exhale: Hope, Healing, and a Life in Transplant. And I know listeners can find out much more about you and your work at davidweilmd.com. You know, a lot of people are feeling burnt out for different reasons these days. What would you like to leave people with about that and about life in general?
Well, I think these are tough times. I think we already, I believe, had an epidemic of loneliness before we had the coronavirus epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to, at all costs, no matter what, avoid isolation. Isolation is the absolute enemy. There's tons of research showing that people that are isolated, people that are lonely, develop not only emotional problems, but physical ones as well. We've got to stay connected.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.